Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, in the fall of 1954, he published a piece in the Yiddish newspaper, the Tug Morgan Journal. This was part of a series that Rav Soloveitchik was writing about various issues, and he tells a story, a personal story. I don't know if this happened that year in 1954 or earlier. He tells the story of a young man who moved to a suburb of Boston, which is where he lived. And the neighborhood, the community in which this young man lived, had only one synagogue. And the only synagogue in his neighborhood had pews that were mixed. It had seating, which was men and women together. So this man asked Rabbi Soloveitchik whether or not, what he should do, how he could hear the Tkiyas Shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Until then, on account of the fact that it was mixed seating in the shul, he had not davened in the shul, but Rosh Hashanah, the Yom HaDin, the mitzvah d'oraisa once a year of Tkiyas Shofar. So how could we, you know, what are we going to do? How do we miss that? So what should he do? So Rav Soloveitchik said to him that it was better for him to pray at home both on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and not cross the threshold of that synagogue. A few days later, he writes, he telephoned me again. He had met the man who was to sound the shofar in the shul, and the man warned him that if he didn't come to the shul, the tokea would not blow for him. He would not sound the shofar a second time, privately, for this individual. So the young man, said Rav Soloveitchik, practically implored me that I grant him permission to enter the edifice, at least for the half hour, to hear the tzkius. I hesitated not for a moment, but directed him to remain at home. It would be better not to hear the shofar than enter a synagogue whose sanctity had been profaned. That's the story. And he wasn't the only Soloveitchik who had a strong opinion on this. You know, there's a wonderful gentleman in West Rogers Park. His name is Mr. Marilis. So he was a student of the late Gaon Rav Aharon Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, when Rav Aharon was a Rosh Yeshiva in Beis Medrash LaTorah in Skokie Yeshiva. So Mr. Marilis is a musmach, should be called Rabbi Marilis. He's a musmach of HTC. And he said that when he received smicha, Rav Aharon required as a tenai, as a condition, that he sign a written commitment that he not serve in a pulpit in which the seats were mixed in that shul, and if he were, his smicha would be retroactively revoked. So this was a controversy, this was a sensitive issue which was still brewing in the 70s. If you want the history behind this, which we're not going to focus on today, if you open your Maror Makomos, you see on the top the debate over mixed seating in the American synagogue by Jonathan Sarna. So he has in this work, it was published in the late 80s by Jack Wertheimer, The American Synagogue, A Sanctuary Transformed. So the 13th chapter, here you get the whole story from the 19th century, the development of synagogues. In Europe, most synagogues do not have mechitzas, they have balconies. Exactly. But in America, this became a very sensitive topic, especially in the 1950s. And again, we're not passing judgment on anybody, especially here in Chicago. There was a prominent Talmud Chacham whose name was Rav Chaim David Regensburg, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who authored a sefer called Mishmeres Chaim and was the Rosh Yeshiva here in Hebrew Theological College. And he was one of the few serious Talmidei Chachamim who allowed his musmachim to take positions in non-mechitza shuls, which is probably why I had never heard of something called a traditional synagogue until I moved to Chicago. I suspect that that has something to do with HTC Musmachim from the 50s and 60s, whatever the tkufa, not so probably because of the influence of Tells, but I suspect that that's why such a phenomenon exists in Chicago or in the Midwest. It's probably because of the influence of Rabbi Regensburg, who allowed his Talmidim to take positions in such shuls. But since that time, before and after that time, the majority opinion, there are some exceptions, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But generally, that is not acceptable for a musmach. Let's say once in a long while, you'll have someone today. I remember when I was in YU, there was a question about someone who's a little older than me in the smicha program who was discussing with Rav Schechter if he could take a particular shul where it has, I don't remember, if it didn't have a mechitza or it didn't have one of the minyanim didn't have a mechitza or the mechitza was of a particular height. And the question was, if he could go there, would he be able to influence them to change the mechitza? Maybe there was a certain amount of time. We'll come back to that a little bit later. But barring this, I would say, more local or regional issue, this was a strongly held position. And if you want the real full scope of this controversy, you need this volume. It's called The Sanctity of the Synagogue, The Case for Mechitza, Separation Between Men and Women in the Synagogue by Baruch Litvin. This is the book that you need. The edition that I'm holding in front of me is from the late 80s. You see the Detroit Jewish News had an article about this third expanded edition by Jeannie, I don't know how to pronounce her name, Jeannie Litvin. This is the author, Baruch Litvin, and this is the picture of his synagogue, Beth Tfila Moses Synagogue, Mount Clemens, Michigan. This is a fascinating story. You will not find the shul anymore, because the shul was transformed into something else shortly after the conclusion of this episode. What was the episode? The episode was that the board of the synagogue wanted to change the structure of the shul from having a mechitza and removing the mechitza. And this balabas, this man, Baruch Litvin, took them to court. And this question made its way all the way up to the Michigan State Supreme Court, which upheld the lower court's ruling, which was that in point of fact, if you are an Orthodox synagogue, you must have a mechitza. And therefore, if the charter of the synagogue is to be Orthodox, then the Balabatim have no right to take away the mechitza. And so the secular court upheld the ruling of halacha to require a mechitza. Well, Baruch Litvin, this was a crusade. It was a personal crusade. By the end of this, he had amassed many, many fascinating rabbinic sources and letters. It's not a difficult book to get a hold of. It is absolutely fascinating. It's also a story of tragedy, because by the end of this episode, he had extended significant personal expense, had no friends, the shul maintained the mechitza, and then what happened? It closed. They sold the property because they didn't have a constituency that was going to support. But it's interesting how, even though you could argue it was on one level a tragedy, on the other hand, his personal heroic effort was galvanizing a movement to support a traditional approach. When I'm going to say traditional from now on, it means traditional in the
traditional sense.
In the traditional sense, not the Chicago sense. The traditionally held halachic perspective that you require, and just this gift for scholars and for students, it's written, it's very easy. Everything in here is in English. All the pieces are translated. He has letters from every possible rabbinic personality that you could imagine from the 20th century, and then tshuvas that are translated from before. It's the work on this issue. Maybe there are others, but I think this is the work. And what we're going to look at today is a couple of the makoros and maybe a new way of thinking about this issue. Because today, I don't think it's so much of a burning controversy as much as it was in the 50s and 60s. But this controversy really gives us a point of reflection that we need to actually introspect based on, I think, two elements that we're going to learn here. Because the notion of a mechitza, it's actually a barrier. It is a line of demarcation, which today, in some circles, actually is controversial. So when I was looking around, I did see that in some places, it's causing some question, let's say, in more, in non-Orthodox contexts, should they allow a mechitza minyan? Or does the fact that a barrier exists, does that itself create tension? So There's something that I want to reflect on here as it relates to the concept of a mechitza. Mechitza is something that delineates two reshuyos, two different areas, and how it relates to tefillah in general. The key marmakom, the key source for this issue, is a mission in Enema Sechah Sukkah that you see on the bottom in source number one. Misha lo ra simchas besa shoeva lo ra simcha miyamav. If you were not present to witness the joy of the drawing of the water in the mikdash for the nisach hamayim, for the pouring of the water on the mizbeach on the holiday of Sukkot, you did not see joy in your days. What would they do? B'motzei yom tov rishon shel chag, on motzei, the first night of yontif, yardu le'ezras nashim, they went down to the ezras nashim, umesaknin sham tikun gadol, and they were literally lesakein means to fix or to construct or erect. They were fixing something that was a big fixing. So what are we talking about here? So imagine for a second, and we're going to use this imagery significantly. Imagine this is the Aron in the Beis HaMikdash that's placed in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. That's on the westernmost edge. So let's say if you're standing at the Kotel, when you look at the wall, you're actually looking at the back of the Beis HaMikdash. Right opposite you would be the Kodesh HaKadoshim. In front of the Aron is the Parochas, which is Mavdil. Then you have the Kodesh. In front of the Kodesh, you have a wide antechamber called the Ulam. In front of the Ulam, you have the area right before the Mizbeach. So this looks like maybe it could be a Mizbeach. In front of the Mizbeach was an open area. We're moving from west to east, which is called the Azara. This whole area where the Mizbeach is and around the back of the Heichal, that's all the Azara. This is only part of the Azara. This is the part of the Azara called Ezras Kohanim. No Yisraelim are allowed to walk there. If you go further east, there's a section that is called Ezras Yisrael. That's where Yisraelim are allowed to go, men. Then there is a set of doors called the Shari Nikanor. There are 15 stairs, and you go down the 15 stairs to what's called the Ezras Nashim, the women's gallery. So the women's gallery was lower than the men's gallery, which was higher. So they were yardu, they went down. It makes sense they would go down, because they would go down, it was on a lower level. So generally speaking, just first step, the Ezras Nashim, the women's gallery in the Mikdash, was on a different floor than the men's gallery, which was on the upper deck. This was on the lower deck. Okay, what were they doing? What was the big Tikkun Gadol that they were doing? So the Gemara explains, here, turn the page. My Tikkun Gadol, what was the big fixing they were doing? Am Reb Elazar, Ka'osa Shishaninu, like we saw, like we have a tradition that we learn, Chalaka Ha'isa Berishona. Initially, the Ezras Nashim, the women's gallery at the bottom, which was, imagine, it looked like a square courtyard with four offices, one in each corner. It was a big open area, and it was flat, initially. Vehikifua, and they surrounded the perimeter on the interior, Gezuztura. Gezuztura, I love that word, it's a great word, it's like, it's a good ring to it. Gezuztura literally means a porch or an awning or a balcony. So they arranged around the periphery of the Ezras Nashim a porch. Vihiskinu, and they fixed it. Sheyu Nashim Yoshvos Milamaila. The women sat on the top of the balcony. Va'anashim Milamata. And the men, they sat below. That was the model. Tana Rabbanu, we learned in a Braisa Barishona initially, Hayu Nashim Mibifnim Va'anashim Mibachutz. Initially, what they had in the Ezras Nashim was that they had men and women, but they were separate, but that they were on the same level. The women were sitting on the inside, and the men were sitting on the outside. They were, by the way, they were allowed to sit in this section of the Beis HaMikdash because the Ezras Nashim did not, there were different strata of Kedusha. The Ezras Nashim did not have the same level of Kedusha as the Ezras Yisrael or as the Ezras Kohanim. You are not allowed to sit in the Azara, in the main section of the Beis HaMikdash, unless you were the king, the Melech from Malchus Beis David. That's the rule. Kohanim were not allowed to sit there. There may have been an exception, according to some Rishonim, for eating kachim, but according to the majority of the Rishonim, the only time anybody ever sat in the Azara was the king of Melech from Malchus based on it. That's it. But in the Ezra's Nashim, people were allowed to sit there. Okay, that might...
Even in the Ezra's Kohanim, if you were
Kohanim could not sit there. That's correct. The level of Kedusha was so high that it would be disrespect. It would be not deferential to the Makom of Kedusha. So the off of the Ezra's Kohanim was the dormitory. It was called the Beis Hamoked. And they had places where you could sit and they would sleep. But that Lishka was where they slept, was not, didn't have the Kedusha of the Azara. As opposed to the Ezra's Nashim, Sir Rav Shechter Shlita, he explains, quotes from Rav Soloveitchik, and this is part of a longer discussion, which we'll see in Nafka Mina from this in a minute. He says that the reason why they were not Mekadesh the Ezra's Nashim to the same extent that the Ezra's Anashim is that they had Rachmanis. Many women, they come with children, or they come and they're pregnant, and it's very difficult for them to stand the whole time. So in order to accommodate them, they did not create the same level of Kedusha. They were not Mekadesh the Ezra's Nashim, so that anybody could sit there. Imagine if you have older folks also, it's hard for them to, an older Kohen is going to come do the Avoda, he needs a place to sit down, so he can go to the Beis Hamoked, or he could sit in the Ezra's Nashim. All right, I'll say it now. If you think about it in this light, you can understand why, when we think about the Beis HaKnesses as a mini Beis HaMikdash, it's a Mikdash Ma'at, so then there are going to be a lot of parallels between the Beis HaMikdash and the Shul, which is why, when you build a shul, Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Shechter held, like many Achronim, the Ezra's Nashim does not have the same level of Kedusha as the Ezra's Anashim. And therefore, let's say you want to reconfigure the shul, if you want to change the configuration of the shul, so Rav Shechter quotes in the Mipanini HaRav that Rav Soloveitchik held, if you were going to reconfigure the shul and you were going to take some of the men's section and make it into the women's section, you actually have to sell the men's section so that you could be mafkia the Kedusha, so that you can remove the Kedusha from the men's section, because you're not allowed to be borried from the Kedusha of the men's section to the women's section, which is patterned after the Beis HaMikdash. What's that? So that's a whole discussion, how you sell a shul and on what condition you sell a shul. That's a good question. And who has the authority to sell the shul? That's a whole discussion in Maseches Megillah. It's a big discussion in Shulchan Aruch. But the principle of the matter is that the origin of this idea of Shechter quotes and Rav Soloveitchik is that it's from the Beis HaMikdash, that the women's gallery was designed for a place where people could sit. So it had a lower level of Kedusha than the Azara. So, so the question was, what happens on Rosh Hashanah when they open the social hall? So the answer is that we are not, let's say as a community, we are not endowing the social hall with the Kedusha of a Beis HaKnesses. For example, right? So it's not a joke, by the way. This is one of the things that Rav Shechter talks about, that when a person comes to shul, bechlal, there's an issue of sensitivity that, okay, in some shuls, there are no women there during the week. There's never been a woman there. Okay, so if that's the case, it's fine. But in a shul where sometimes there are women who come there, it's not proper to sit in the women's section and daven there because it makes a woman uncomfortable. Why does she have to come in and chase out the men? It's a very big problem. We had this once in the Beis Medrash here where we had some men who were davening in the back, and I spoke to Rabbi Engel where he had to make a macha that people should not daven in the women's section. But Rav Shechter has a different point, which is that if you are a man and you belong in the men's section, so the Kedusha of the men's section is distinct from the women's section, so you shouldn't daven in the women's section. But in the social hall, it's like the Gemara says, there was something in the old days, they had something called Rechova Shel'ir. When they had a fast day and they had to gather, they didn't have a gymnasium. They didn't have an auditorium. Where would they gather when they had to get the whole community together? In the town square. So they used to take out the Aron Kodesh to the town square, and they would daven there. So Mishnah is Maseches Tanis. So the Mishnah and Megillah, and the end of Megillah says, yeah, that doesn't have the Kedusha of the Kedusha Beis HaKnesses. It happened to be that people daven there, but it wasn't fixed as a mokum of Kedusha Beis HaKnesses. So when they open the social hall up, the social hall does not have Kedushas Beis HaKnesses. For Haraya, we eat in the social hall. Now, even today, outside of Israel, we make a Tanai that we could eat in the main shul. A lot of shuls, when you go there, they'll have sometimes a Kiddush in the shul in a shtibel where they don't have a social hall, and that's because they make a condition. But Me'ikar Me'ikar Adin, you're not allowed to eat in a shul. There's no eating in a shul. It's a pchisas kavod for the Beis HaKnesses. It's a lack of respect. So theoretically, we would not be allowed to eat in here, but you would be allowed to eat in the social hall, even if, let's say, they said on condition, once in a while, let's say, God forbid, during COVID, remember, we had to have a minyan in the social hall. That didn't mean that the social hall now has a din Beis HaKnesses. This goes back to the original question, which, you know, there's a whole question of how you create Kedushas Beis HaKnesses, what the origins of that is. These are all important things, not so much for today. Yeah, last point. So that's an interesting question about creating a space for a woman. So that there is an interesting discussion in the Achronim. There were times where let's say you had a balcony, but they had a tanai in the Beis HaKnesses that if you had a woman who couldn't walk up the stairs, so they would cordon off. And I remember this growing up in the Aguda in Baltimore, they have two women's sections. They have the women's balcony upstairs, but they had downstairs. So oftentimes they'll have that as, I don't know if that was built in as the original Tanai or that's, you know, it's technically still the Kedusha Space of Knesset, but it's not a problem because there's the Mechitza. It's a good question. But it's not uncommon. Okay. So let's get back here. I want to understand, what is this Tikkun Gol? Says the Gemara, Tan Rabbanan, Barishono Hayunashim Mibifnim, the women sat in the inside, Va'anashim Mibachutz, the men sat in the outside, Va'yubon Li Dei Kalas Rosh. It created a situation of levity. So this is a problem that we have to think about. It's true, in most of the shuls in our communities, we have mixed kiddushim and we have mixed weddings, but we have to think about, wait a second, you know, where's the propriety here? What are the appropriate boundaries? There are a lot of interesting discussions in the Achronim about what happens if you have mixed seatings at weddings and sheva brachos and things like that. That's not our minhag to have separate seating in most of our communities. But at the same time, my wife is my wife and your husband is your husband. And sometimes you see outrageous things. You see outrageous things in a Beis HaKnesses. That sometimes it's not even in the hallway. Sometimes it's in the Kiddush room. Somebody sees somebody else's wife. They haven't seen them in a long time. They give them a big hug and a kiss. That's it's Bonli de Kalos Rosh. That's totally unacceptable. We can't have that. So we have to remind ourselves that there's personal space for men and there's personal space for women. And we're not getting into whether that's derechiba, derechibas bia, isudaraisa. It's not appropriate. It's not that's Bonli de Kalos Rosh. There has to be an appropriate respect of distance between genders. And that's what was happening. So they said, okay, we're going to fix this problem. They're going to put the men on the inside. Because maybe, potentially, the problem was that the men were on the outside and they were looking at all the women on the inside. They wanted to get into conversation with them. So we're going to put the women on the outside. Generally speaking, when you have a problem between men and women, the problem is the men. We are the problem, generally speaking. The women, Nashim Tzidkanios, but this was the first attempt to solve this problem. Then the Gemara says this also didn't solve the problem of too much intermingling that was at a level that violated the din of respecting boundaries between genders. So we said, Adayin Oyubon L'Dei Kalos Rosh, we said, Eskinush Yu Nashim, we have a fix. Fifth line. Nashim Yoshvus Milamaila, we're going to put the women upstairs, Va'anashim Milamata, and the men downstairs. So the Gemara has a very serious problem. Hechi Ovid Hachi, how did they do this? Vaksiv Hakol Bichsav Mi Hashem Alai Hiskil. Everything in the Beis Hamikdash was done according to a divine prescription. You can't just walk into the Beis Hamikdash and say, "You know what? We're going to renovate. We're going to renovate. We're going to move. You know, the Shulchan is going to go over there, and the Menorah is going to go." You can't do that. Every element of this structure is paralleling a spiritual world, Hakol Bichsav. It's Al Pi Navi. It's based on a prophet. You can't just make a change. Says the Gemara. Amar Rav. Rav says, Kro Ashkechu V'Darosh. It's true. They had to find a Pasuk. They had to find a Pasuk as a source for a license to create this. Pasuk says, V'safta ha'aretz mishpachas, mishpachas levad. Mishpachas based of levad and Hashem levad. There's going to come a time, lost love, where there's going to be a great eulogy. And there's going to be separation of the genders, mishpachas le mishpachas. So mishpachas based over the men on this side, the women on that side. They said halutvarim kal v'chomer. It's obvious. Fourth line from the bottom of the piece in source number two. Umalo asid lavo she'asukin behesped. In the time to come, when they're going to be, this is going to be the future eulogy, they're going to be involved in hesped. And the Gemara says in Kiddushin, generally, at a funeral, when people are focused on something somber, they're not going to get involved in licentiousness and frivolity and inappropriate interactions. Ve'in yetzer hara sholeit b'hem. Amar Torah, anoshim levad v'noshim levad. The men and the women are going to be separate. Achshav, she'asukim b'simcha. That there is joy. Ve'yetzer hara sholeit b'hem. People are... they're happy, and sometimes that happiness could spill over from the happiness of Ruchnius to being loose. Alachas kama v'kama, of course. You have to be careful. You have to be careful. So we see that this notion of having a separation of genders exists already in the Beis HaMikdash, and it's rooted in a biblical principle. Because if this was not a din d'oraisa, they would not have the authority, say many achronim, to institute this in the Beis HaMikdash. So now, before we get to the heart of the chakir of how you understand this issue of mechitza, this comes back to what we said earlier, which is that the model of mechitza is where? The Beis HaMikdash. Well, perhaps that, therefore, is why the concept of mechitza is going to translate dafka to a shul, a Beis HaKnesses. And that's why people are very sensitive about the mechitza dafka in the shul. But let's say if you go, Rachmana Litzlan, to a Beis Avel, you go to a house of mourning, at least the Beis Avel that I've been to, they don't put up a mechitza. Or, let's say you're davening on a plane. So, why don't they put up a mechitza? So Shlomo Zalman writes, they quote from him in Halicha Shlomo, he says, when you daven on a plane, that's not a Beis HaKnesses. And therefore, there's no requirement for a Beis HaKnesses. There's no requirement to look like a Beis HaKnesses, so you don't have a requirement to put up a mechitza. So you could be, obviously, the precursor to this is that the flight attendants say that it's okay, and you're not keeping somebody, you know, the guy who was trapped in the bathroom, Lo Aleinu? He got trapped there before Baruch Sha'amar. It's a Thursday, someone brought a Sefer Torah, he's still in there. He's just suffocating to death in that tiny, the bathroom is like this size. So you make sure you're not blocking the area to the restroom, or whatever, but you don't need a mechitza. And the same thing, it's certainly not proper that men and women should be davening together in the Beis Avel, but you don't need mechitza. Very often, the women will go to the back, or to the side, or to the front, wherever, probably not to the front, they will go to the side, or to the back, and the men will daven, but there's no mechitza.
In the pop-up minyanim.
Yes, pop-up minyanim in people's backyards during COVID. Technically speaking, you didn't need a mechitza. Oh. As we'll talk about at the end, it would totally be unacceptable and improper for men and women literally to be davening together, but you don't need a mechitza. This din, which sounds like it's a din d'oraisa of requirement of mechitza, it's a din of mikdash. And this space that we're in right now is a mikdash ma'at, so it needs a mechitza al pi din. Outside there's no requirement for a mechitza. So that comes up all the time, like you said, pop-up minyanim, things like that. So the women will stay in one place, the men will stay in a different place. Okay, but the question is, why? Why was there a mechitza? I understand that the purpose of the mechitza was to prevent the inappropriate behavior that was happening in the mikdash because of this intermingling. So if you look at the Rambam of the Pirush of Mishnayos, says, Tikkun Godol wrote to Lomar, Godol hatoelis, it had a great function. Vu kiyam, they were setting up mesaknim makom la'anashim, makom la'anashim. Source number three, umakom anashim la'mayla. The women's gallery was above mi makom anashim. Kadesh lo yistaklu ho anashim b'nashim. That the men should not look at the women. That's the Rambam, the simple understanding. What's that?
Why are they doing this on Motzei?
Because they didn't do the Simchas Pesach Shaveva on Yantif. It's not Docha Yantif. They had fireworks and juggling that was not on Yantif. It was only Chol Moed. That's why today there's a common practice of, let's say, in many places in shuls and in Chassidish Shtiblach and Yerushalayim, they have Simchas Pesach Shaveva, but it's only during the week. It was not Docha Shabbos. They had to light huge torches. The Mishnah says the torches that they lit were enormous. They lit up like stadium lighting. All Yerushalayim was lit up from this. So it was Dafka Motzei, before the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, they would put this up. So the Rambam says, it's Kadesh Lo Yistaklu, and the Tosfos Yom Tov writes in the Mishnah, he says, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But the Sridi Eish, he says, yeah, that may be Lav Dafka, so we're going to have to come back to this. But the first way of understanding this, the Rambam in the Pirush Mishnah, is that the men should not look at the women. Now, in general, the men should be minding their own business, and the women should be minding their own business. But at the same time, just like we have a principle, v'yisim nikiyim, if I, the Mishnah says that in Shkalim, if I was the Kohen who was responsible for taking the Trumas Halishka, which was every year they had a major fundraising effort to buy korbanos for the korbanos tzibur. This is the time. Yesterday we just read Parsha Shkalim. Why do you read Parsha Shkalim? This is the time. People give a machzor shekel and they contributed to the fund. They had probably in the Beis HaMikdash's time, they had blue tzedakah boxes and they sent them around collecting for the machzor shekel. And then at the end of all the collection, they had one kohen who would go in. Nobody else was there. And he would separate a portion that was going for the karbonos, and then the rest went for other things, the Mishnayos and Shkolim. So the din is, the kohen who went in, he couldn't have pockets. Why couldn't he have pockets? Because people would say, oh, he put something in his pocket, and therefore, if the next week he won, you know, he went and he bought, I don't know, Ferragamo shoes in the supermarket, everybody would say, oh, you know how you afford those Ferragamo shoes? It was my machzor shekel. Or, if God forbid, the next week, the guy lost his shirt in business, they would say, ah, you know why he lost his shirt? Because the Rebbe Shalom was punishing him for taking money. So therefore, there's a din of v'yisim nikiyim. So you ask yourself, wait a second, v'yisim nikiyim, everybody should mind their own business. So it's true, everybody should mind their own business, but at the same time, everybody has a little Gladys Kravitz Yitzhahara. You know, we have a little, well, like you know, this, we have a little episode of that. So that's true. Why? It's true. The men should only be looking at men, and they shouldn't be looking at what the women are doing. But at the same time, women have to comport themselves in a way which, if men are looking, shouldn't be problematic. So Rav Avadia has many tshuvas, and a lot of people have discussions about this that relates to the way that women dress. Because the Teva Ha'olam is that men are attracted to women, and if women dress in a way which is very provocative, so it's true, the men shouldn't be involved with the women, but it's not a license for women to dress in a way which is provocative and inappropriate. I don't want to discuss this topic by Arichus, but it's an important understanding that we put the onus on the men. But at the same time, there's a responsibility for women to dress in an appropriate fashion. So according to the Rambam, in the Pirush HaMishnayos, the purpose of the balcony was that so the men should not look at the women. But if you look at the Rambam in the Yad HaChazaka, in Hilchos Lulav, in Perek Ches Halacha Yud Beis, the Rambam says they would put up this balcony, go to the fourth line to the end, the women would go above, and the men would be on the lower level, that they should not mingle and mix with each other. Says the Sridi Eish, when the Rambam said, he just meant so that the women would be above, and the men wouldn't be gazing intently at them, because the word histaklus has the connotation of intense gazing and looking. But really, the primary issue, says the Sridi Eish, is what the Rambam says in the Yad. These two approaches are going to determine the next controversy, right? So the first controversy is, do you have mechitza and shul? So we see it's clear from the Mikdash, sounds like it's a din d'oraisa, that there is a requirement for a din of a mechitza and shul. The question is, naniach, that is d'oraisa, which is what Rav Moshe has several tshuvas about this. Next page in source number 5, Orach Chaim, Chelek Aleph, Siman Lamed Tes. The right-hand side, he points out that it's a din d'oraisa. The left-hand side is, he thinks the purpose of this mechitza is shelo yisarvu, that they shouldn't mix. So what's going to prevent mixing? So Rav Moshe's shita is, v'lechein, top left column, b'mechitza gavoa. How tall is the mechitza? Ad achar haksefayim. Shoulder height. Shemistaber, he says, it's logical, she'ein lovely de kalas rosh, that if you have a mechitza which is shoulder height, it's not going to be that men and women who are sitting along the mechitza are basically going to be sitting next to each other. Shoulder length. Let's go with my shoulder, right? Or because somebody else, whatever. So he says, I'll tell you what the objective shear is. He says, I'll tell you. Hu gova gimel amos. Three amos, which is actually a Talmudic discussion. The Bali Atosis, the Gemara, has this discussion. People, at least in the times of the Gemara, were either three amos or four amos tall. There's a question. The simple understanding is that there was three amos until the shoulder and then one ama for the head and the neck. So how tall is three amos? Yud ches tfachim. 18 tfachim. How tall is a tefach? So probably the smallest shear of a tefach is maybe, well, it's tricky because there is a range. Rav Chaim Noah on the shorter end. Rav Moshe thinks that an amah is about 21 and a change. And the Chazon Ish is bigger than that, closer to 24 inches, I think. So depending on how you're going to measure it, let's say your average tefach is 4 inches. Let's say we'll go with a more middle shear. 4 inches. The tefach is a hand breadth, so it's the width of your hand breadth. Let's say it's about 4 inches. So 4 inches times 18 is 72 inches, which is 6 feet. So according to Rav Moshe, the mechitza needs to be 6 feet. Now, how do you construct that mechitza of 6 feet? Well, let's go back. The purpose of this is that it shouldn't have kalos rosh. We shouldn't have levity. So if we're talking about a physical barrier, that could be a glass barrier between the two genders. It could be a transparent glass barrier. They're not going to be misarif if it's 6 feet tall, exactly like what we have here. But we did have, and we do have, another concern, which was the Rambam and the Pirush and Mishnayos about histaklus. So even if you're not going to be concerned about that formally, and you don't think that the machayiv of the mechitza is shelo histaklu, but what if you have women who are not dressed appropriately for reciting Kriyat Shema and Shemona Esrei and davening, because we know that exposed parts of a person's body, both for men and for women, poses a halachic problem for reciting brachos and davening and learning. So if you have women who are not dressed, it's much easier for the men, because for us, we don't have to cover that much. But for women, there's a lot more that needs to be covered. That's not for today's discussion. But if you have women who are, as the Gemara says in brachos, erva ba'ashashis, if you have something which is halachically offensive because it's overexposure of someone's body, even if it's behind a glass case, it's still a problem because the vision, the field of vision is not occluded. So you have to take into consideration this additional concern, even if it's not shelo yistaklu, because the women are visible, but what if we have a consideration that there are things which are unsightly from a halachic sensitivity standpoint? So that's why you will find that the women's section generally is not just one pane of glass for consideration of that, but technically speaking, if it's an issue of shelo yisarvu, it could just be one pane of glass. The exact opposite approach is taken by the Satmar Rav in this tshuva in Orach Chaim and Yud, where he says, what are you talking about? No! Ikar achlatoso shehechlet she'in lochash l'istakla ze'eno! In source number 6, this idea that we're not worried about the men looking at the women, that's not the issue. Barama Zalba Pirush and Mishnais and Sukkah said Beferish, it's about looking. And therefore, the women's gallery must be constructed in such a fashion that the men cannot see the women. So when I grew up in our shtiebel, when I was very young in our shtiebel, the women, it was literally a shtiebel, it was a house. So the Rebbe would live upstairs and on the main floor, and there was the Ezos Nashim on the other side. So kind of like at the top of the front of the men's section, there was one section of the wall that you could slide open. So maybe, I think there was some like echo that possibly reached the other side. I think, possibly. But then in the new shul, when they built the new shul, they had these portable mechitzas, which were wood. They were not bulletproof, but it was close. They were wood, and then the top part of it was curtains. And then, so it was like about 8 feet tall, the mechitza. And on some chastoras, sometimes they would take the curtain and flip it up so they could see what was going on. At a certain point, my mother stopped davening with us. She started davening across the street because she decided that she would rather daven somewhere where she could see and hear what was going on, especially on Yontif when we said Yotzros, where even the men didn't know what was going on. So certainly the women didn't know what was going on. But We daven in the shtibel, the Rav of our shtibel, the Rebbe of our shtibel, Rav Amram Taub Zecher Tzadok Levracha. See, he was a Talmud of the Satmar Rav. He came from Hungary. The Satmar Rav sent him to Baltimore. That was a sine qua non. Obviously, it was going to be mechitza. That was going to be according to the standards of the Satmar Rav. So it couldn't be that any men would see any women. Here's the third position, and this is the position of Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik. He says, wait a second. If this is a mechitza, we know that halachically, the din of a mechitza has other contexts to create a separation of reshuyos, the separation of the different properties. So there is the property of a private domain. What distinguishes a private domain is the fact that it is separated by a mechitza. How tall is that mechitza? That mechitza is a minimum of 10 tefachim. So what was Rav Soloveitchik's view on mechitza? So you have here a letter. Once again, Chicago connections. His family is from Chicago, Rabbi Learfield. I put his letter here partially because he just passed away. His neshama should have an aliyah. It was wonderful whenever I would go to visit my in-laws and I would daven in their shul during the week just to hear his mishabera for cholim, which was basically like an auction. Sick men, sick women, sick men, sick women. It was unbelievable. He was so vivacious. He was in his 80s. He wore the same black suit, the same black tie, and the same black suspenders, I think from his days as a young person. He was the Messiah Gittin in South Florida. My mother-in-law still remembers that when she was a child, he was a Rev in this shul in Knesset Israel congregation. This was in South Beach back in the 60s, the 50s and 60s. He was still a Rev there when I would go years ago. He was in the Young Israel of Greater Miami. My mother-in-law said that he would stop. It was very hot in the summertime. So when he was driving the hearse, he would stop at Carvel on the way to the cemetery. he was a very, very Levitic person. And his neshama should have an aliyah. His wife should live and be well. She's my grandmother, Bubby's best friend, Miriam Learfield. They have like the Rebbetzins. It was Mrs. Rebbetzin Gross and Rebbetzin Learfield. And then there was a younger woman, Rebbetzin Barbara Shapiro. Her husband was the rabbi of a big shul in Miami Beach. So they had like a chevra of the Rebbetzins. So anyway, so Rabbi Learfield, it was a great opportunity. Cantor Seif, this is going back family stories. So he writes a letter to Baruch Litvin. It's published in the back of the book. He says, I don't know what you heard about our mechitza. You heard a rumor our mechitza is going to be 40 inches. That's not true. Quote, we called Rabbi Dr. J.P. Soloveitchik long distance in the 60s. He called from Miami to Boston. I don't know. That must have cost like 12 cents or something. You know, my grandmother, Allah Shalom, in Israel, she used to be like, when we would call Israel, she's like, we're talking for too long. I'm like, Bobby, it doesn't cost anything anymore. But it was long distance. Long distance. And we asked him, what was his opinion for the minimum height of the mechitza? He told us 48 inches or 4 feet. That was the Rav's ruling for them, 48 inches. Our mechitza is going to be 52 inches. It is not going to be the highest in the land, nor is it going to be the lowest in the land. And seeing as we have Rabbi Soloveitchik's approval for 48 inches, we are building it 4 inches higher. We feel he is a great enough man upon whom we can rely, etc. Rav Schefter has a story in the Pnimi Harav. Take a look at this interesting story on the next column. He says he heard this story with one of the yeshiva boys who is going to be a rabbi, a Yamim Noraim rabbi, as a guest rabbi in the High Holy Days in a shul, in an Orthodox shul in Pennsylvania for Yamim Noraim, and he was going to make a good amount of money. The thing is that the mechitza in this place was slightly lower than 40 inches. So he asked Rav Soloveitchik's opinion. And the Rav said not to go. That he should not serve in a congregation where the mechitza was lower than 40 inches tall. So the Talmud asked him, Rebbe, but I thought we heard in your name that a mechitza needs to be 10 tefachim. And b'di'eved, you could say that a tefach is 3.6 inches, so this is higher than 10 tefachim. So the Rav said to him, it's true. That is my opinion. But that's true for a rabbi who is going to be there for the entire year and develop relationships with people and inspire them and facilitate their growth and give them mussar and influence them and have a hashpah on them. And so for that, you could be makel to have the lowest shear of the mechitza with the lowest shear of a tefach. It's acceptable. But you're just going there for a couple of days to make a few dollars. You're a single guy. You have enough money. You don't need a parnasa. And for you, it's not proper to be makel. Just because, you know, editorial comment, I'm stepping aside, just because there is a lenient opinion out there doesn't mean that that's the appropriate opinion. We have to always think about what is appropriate for the context. So to summarize, we're going to close with two key notes that I want to come back to from what we alluded to at the beginning. There are three different approaches when it comes to mechitza. Primarily, Rav Moshe's approach, which is shoulder height because of mixing. The Satmar Rav's approach, which is not seeing out of vision. And Rav Soloveitchik's approach of a different reshus, of a mechitza, which is the din of ten tefachim. Within that, there is a range, and of course, there are so many others who discuss this. But the two things that I think are worth thinking about, and maybe the most important takeaways of this whole Shtickl Torah, is how do we think about the nature, the crux of this machlokas, this barrier, this point of contention, this separation? I gave you here, in source number 9, a letter. And to me, this is the most powerful letter in this entire book, the collection of letters, the selected letters and communications of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Because you understand at this point how forceful the Rav was, how strongly he felt about the issue of mechitza. And yet, as much as the mechitza is a divider, it should not become divisive. You can still stand for something. You can stand for a divider, but you can still transcend that with a personal relationship. Just because you follow the tradition that you're committed to halacha doesn't mean that you can't find ways to build bridges. Rav Soloveitchik was invited to the dinner of a new temple, B'nai Moshe, a conservative synagogue in Brighton, Massachusetts. And they were marking the dedication of the new temple and a dinner in honor of the rabbi and Rebbetzin, Rabbi and Mrs. Joseph Shubau. So this fellow, Rabbi Shubau, staunchly conservative rabbi, was a personal friend and an ally of Rav Soloveitchik during Rav Soloveitchik's difficult time when people went after him in Boston for various halachic positions that he took. He had a personal friendship with the rabbi of a conservative shul that had no mechitza. And the Rav writes a letter to me. This letter is so powerful. It's so instructive. Where he opens his heart and he builds an emotional bridge with the president of the shul, Philip Fleischer. He says, I'm stuck. I have a problem. I was faced with an unpleasant situation because you invited me to come to this dinner. On the one hand, I was eager to accept your invitation. Next page. He says, I consider Rabbi Shubau a dear and distinguished friend. And if the dinner were given in his honor, of their honor, I would consider it a privilege to attend. On the other hand, it will also serve as an occasion to celebrate the completion and dedication of the new temple. And listen to what he writes. Let me say unequivocally that I do recognize the importance of this new house of worship for the Jewish population of Brighton as a means of communal organization and unification. Even though, says Rav Soloveitchik, I don't think it has Kedusha Space HaKnesses. I think that it's not acceptable, but it has some value. I can find something to praise. Yet all this does not justify my serving as a sponsor of a dinner at which the dedication of its temple will be celebrated, since the latter will, in all probability, have a mixed seating arrangement, which in my opinion is not in consonance with our time-honored law. Last paragraph. I wish to impress upon you that my words are not to be interpreted in the sense of criticism or censure. I am not a preacher by nature, and I have never tried to convert others who are committed to a different philosophy to my viewpoint. I write this letter with a deep sense of deep humility, explaining to you my feelings on the matter. I hope that you realize and fully understand my position and appreciate my hesitance in accepting an honor which could be in direct opposition to my inner convictions. sincerely yours, after he says, give my best to the Shubals. The Mechitza for Rav Soloveitchik, it was the frontline battle to defend traditional Torah observance, halachic sensibilities, which were literally being compromised to the right and left, to the extent that he would tell somebody to forfeit a mitzvah to Oraisa of Tkiyah Shofar. Astonishing. But that doesn't mean that he couldn't be friends with the rabbi of the non-Mechitza Shul. That he couldn't give them a shkayach for having, recognizing that there's something for that community, even though we think that it's not halachic, it's not orthodox, and it's problematic. But for them, for where they are, maybe there's something for just from communal organization, for them to find some unity. Just because we believe that the Mechitza is indispensable and that we must have a barrier, doesn't mean that it has to become a barrier in personal relationships with other people. And I saw this and heard this with my own eyes in listening to Rav Schwartz, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and how he was able to develop friendships and relationships with all kinds of clergy throughout the community. And that even though, obviously, he was staunch when he went on these rabbinic missions, of course they had davening with mechitzas according to the halacha. But that doesn't mean that you can't connect to another Jew. That's number one. And number two, which is even more important, is pointed out somewhat of a contemporary sense in a blog from a very popular and influential and inspirational woman in Cleveland who is a major educator. She writes a blog called Out of the Orthodox. This was from years ago about mechitzophobia. Do you have mechitzophobia? This is her blog. She goes through all the different elements of mechitzophobia. If you go to the last page, which is the major inyan, you can read this on your own. I feel comfortable in synagogues where I can see and hear. While that might seem obvious, it's important to discuss why. I am in synagogue, she writes, and now full disclosure, she's named Ruchi Koval. She's my first cousin. For one reason, to talk to God. Whatever will enhance that experience, so long as it is within the confines of Jewish law, I would like to incorporate. I am not there to spend time with my husband, nor spend time with my children, nor to catch up with my friends. I am there to talk to God. If you want to hear more from Ruchi about this, you can read her book, Conversations with God, Prayers for the Jewish Woman. Rav Soloveitchik writes, in that same piece where he tells the story about that man, during prayer, man must feel alone, removed, isolated. He must then regard the Creator as an only friend from whom alone he can hope for support and consolation. Why are we going to shul? Had there not been the koach of tefillah b'tzibur, communal davening, where we can answer Kaddish, Kedusha, Barchu, where we can have Kriyas HaTorah, where we can connect to the neshamas of all the other people in the room when we daven, our tefillas yachid is b'tzibur? Had it not been for that dimension, who would have ever had a havamina to come near somebody else? When I daven, I'm supposed to be meditating, connecting, and speaking with the Borei Olam. And it's just us. The truth is that we shouldn't even be aware. If we were on the highest level, I think about this sometimes during davening when I'm looking around. I'm like, why am I looking around? We shouldn't even be aware of who's in shul. It's just a few moments of us and him, kivyachol. The whole issue of mechitza, it's somehow, it's taken us away from what we're even doing here. I shouldn't even be davening next to my children. And if I am, it shouldn't even be as if they exist. I shouldn't be davening with my parents or my friends or my neighbors. Davening is a space to connect with the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's why, halachically, it's true. You don't walk in front of someone who's davening Shemoneh Esrei because it's ke'ilu, the Shechina's right there. Does it matter whether there's a 10-foot mechitza, 12-foot mechitza? It matters for the people on the other side of the mechitza that we should make sure that they have a way to have a meaningful experience in davening. Other than that, who cares who's in the room? It shouldn't be nogea. So the main focus of this whole discussion has to get back to why are we in the shul in the first place? And as Ruchi says, the reason we are in the shul is for one reason. And this is what we need to reflect on. Baruch Hashem, we're not in the mechitza crisis anymore. Although there are sometimes crises in shuls about how to construct the mechitza. But the main thing we need to think about when we come back to this issue over and over is how is everybody experiencing tefillah with the goal of, I am here to talk to God.